Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. With me in the studio this morning is Jeff Bowman, who is the executive director of ACPIRG. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you for letting me be here.
What is ACPIRG a...
Acronym for? I've gotten used to that term as well. ACPIRG is the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, and it's an organization that has been active in Alaska in existence since 1974.
Who first organized this?
It was organized by a group of citizens in Anchorage, people who felt that there was no entity representing a broad range of consumer and public interest, general public policy issues. There were, at the time, even a few groups dealing with some aspects of social policy, social issues, welfare, and so on. And, of course, there has been a healthy environmental community in the state for quite some time. But there was a major part of the spectrum of public concerns that was not being dealt with, things like consumer issues, public policy issues, and the like. And it was simply a group of people who gathered together to start a PIRG, as it were.
Right. This sounds like a group which is focused on Alaskan consumer interests, but that perhaps came out of that whole consumer protectionist movement, most famous for Ralph Nader's Raiders.
Precisely.
Nader's Raiders.
Right.
That were so active in the 60s. I recently heard an interview with someone who's written, a biography of Ralph Nader, and he worked with Nader, and he said that that was the sort of golden age of consumer interest, that Ralph Nader during the 60s was extremely influential in Congress, was an extremely influential lobbyist. It's as if that idea of consumer protectionism, not partisan, not having to do with an official party, just blossomed in the 60s.
I think on reflection that is true in certain ways. It was certainly the birth of that sort of an awareness, that sort of perspective on a broad scale basis. And Ralph Nader was the germ around which things have grown. And ACPIRG certainly is a product of that evolution.
Mm-hmm.
The legacy of Nader, and it's not a past tense legacy by any means, he's still, of course, very active, includes a variety of consumer organizations, and it does include the public interest research groups. Many people are familiar with these organizations because in most states, I believe in 27 states, public interest research groups are associated with the different university campuses and are student-based with student staffs, and at times, depending upon the individual PIRG you're talking about, they might also have non-student professional staff. And by and large, they are supported by tuition and other student fees. That is not true for ACPIRG, and I believe that ACPIRG is unique among what I think are 28 PIRGs in that sense. We operate as a membership organization. We have an independent board of directors. We operate on issues that at times track the national concerns of the PIRG network, but in many cases, even if we are dealing with something in the way of, say, utility issues, and we do have a subordinate program specifically devoted to utility issues called the Alaska Consumer Advocacy Program. But even in those cases where we deal with those national issues, our perspective, of course, is Alaskan, and by virtue of that is somewhat unique. And that unique perspective, as well as the raw opportunity to do things right here, given the limited population size and the fact that we're a young state and that there are so many ways in which we can learn from the experiences of other places, as well as our independence from or lack of funding through a school campus mechanism, have combined to make ACPIRG one that holds Ralph Nader's interests fairly extensively. And he has been in Alaska on two or three occasions on behalf of ACPIRG and continues to be a very supportive person from a distance. I've not had the pleasure of meeting him yet. I hope to soon.
So my understanding of him is just an incredibly concentrated, directed person that puts all of his incredible intensity into his interests. And
yes.
It's very winning kind of. Whether you agree with some of his stances on some of the issues, that kind of concentration and energy is noteworthy.
Oh, absolutely. And I believe that he is also widely regarded for his capabilities of generating enthusiasm and commitment on the part of others, of somehow translating what can be rather mundane or at times esoteric or problematic questions and issues into terms that enable individual
consumers,
common people,
right?
Like you and me to become very energized and mobilized to work on them. And I would like then to bring full circle the question of whether or not the 60s was really the golden age. As I said earlier, I think it was certainly the birthing period and a time when it first became apparent. But I would like to think that the education and the awareness that birthing period resulted in is carried with us today, and in fact that now our attention to all sorts of consumer issues, public policy issues, whatever it might be, is an ingrained and inherent part of our behavior, whereas before it was not. So that in some ways I'd even call this the heyday.
I think the point that was made by the person interviewing the person, and I'm sorry, I'm missing all the names here, of the biographer, the person who just wrote the book about Nader. Mm-hmm. I think he felt that the influence has waned somewhat of lobbyists on consumer protection issues. That his statement was that in the 60s, absolutely they listened. And they were very frightened about this sort of new emerging power and the kind of perhaps just strength of the letters. They might have been listening so attentively because it was such a new lobbying group and such a fervent expression. I don't know that there is less influence. He just felt that there were more people asking for more things now, and that just concentration on that mm-hmm. particular kind of legislation, although certainly wasn't going away, was perhaps slightly diminished. And I have no way of arguing the point or agreeing with
it. Yeah, nor do I. My detailed involvement with public interest issues stems from my coming to work for ACPIRG in August. So that's why I haven't met Ralph Nader, and I don't have the long historic perspective, at least from a personal standpoint, than do others. I do retain the conviction, however, that if anything, much of what was established or done that was so visible and so precedent-setting at the time is now incorporated into the scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas before you had to beat a General Motors over the head to get them to fix a problem with Pintos or whatever the issue might have been back then, now you have recalls regularly taking care of vehicle problems. You have a vast array of legislation and regulation, as well as just public perception and bureaucratic and political sensitivity to the sorts of things that were not considered before.
Mm-hmm. Some of the questions that Ralph Nader and his large group of very committed people asked are now, what you're saying is, those questions are now sort of incorporated into
part
the procedures.
Of the formula. Right.
Part of the formula. You know,
right.
Is this safe?
Right.
What are the consequences of this or that not working? I suppose some of this movement, organized movement for consumer protectionism, is because our lives are so complicated now. It's not really possible for us to make individual decisions about each product that we use and determine whether they're safe.
No, that's very true. And in fact, you can take that same complexity theme and apply it beyond the mere products that we use to the processes that affect us. I'm thinking here in terms of governmental process, to the decisions that are made about costs that we incur. I'm thinking here about utility rates. It's simply not possible for someone who is now at the end of a generating system being funneled through a utility or two or three utility and sub-utilities and into a distribution center and out to an outlet when they plug in their car to stay warm. It's simply not possible for them to grasp what is going on to get that electricity to them and why it is that they're paying what they are. It was far easier when they went out and knew that they had to buy hay for the horse, or that they had to go out and put their own weed burner under the car, and that when they had to pay for the propane, then they knew their car was going to be warm. So complexity just in general has caused people to, in many ways, lose touch, either knowingly or not, with where the decisions that affect them are being made and what those decisions are and what they're based on.
Utilities are actually a good case in point. As a newspaper reader and a listener to news, I would say I'm real confused. They come out with all these great plans about how much energy will be needed based on population growth projections and industry projections, et cetera. And there are states that have found themselves in really significant financial difficulties as a result of those projections, which in fact have not borne out. Washington is one example.
Sure.
With their nuclear power plants. Do you want to speak to that whole issue?
Well, certainly it is fair to say that there is not an adequate broad-based plan for providing energy statewide in Alaska. There has been a potpourri of individual efforts, some efforts at conservation. I think that Fairbanks among communities has benefited fairly extensively, at least relative to other communities, with what is now sort of a dormant program with the conservation program and the energy retrofitting that was quite active a few years back and that has since been defunded. In the vernacular.
Not only defunded, but whatever funding exists has also been distributed around the state. So areas that have actually more severe cold are very severely impacted.
And so we do have, as that program evidences, some efforts to, but they're not coordinated in a very thorough manner. And of course, the big issue these days is the rail belt energy question and how we're going to deal with that and the long-standing option of a Susitna hydroelectric project. That is an issue that is still actively debated. The economic parameters for its viability appear to be becoming ever more confined as oil prices stay lower and as projections being utilized to examine the project are continually modified and reduced. The window of likelihood or certainty that it's going to be the best solution becomes narrower. It's still an open question, but nonetheless, as you point out, the projections continue to change, and we somehow need to break away from preconceived notions of what to do and step back and say, what does Alaska need? What does rural Alaska need? What does urban Alaska need? The rail belt as opposed to Southeast, as opposed to rural Alaska. It's a very disparate set of concerns, and we have to try and address all of them in a collective fashion.
I think that one one thing that's so trying about energy planning is that the plans need to be made so far in advance to bring on a dam or a nuclear power plant or whatever your facility is takes many years of planning, fundraising, and approval from the people of the energy service area. And in this case, it's an all-Alaska decision. That's one complication,
right?
Certainly. The other is how will the cost of energy balance? And it strikes me that we, in some ways, are committed to CSITNA. It looks that way if you look at the legislature. I mean, they have some substantial investment so far, and it looks like a continuing investment. And I have the impression that that's true in other states, that once that ball gets rolling down the hill, because there's so much investment out front of feasibility studies and plans and so on, that it's a very difficult thing to stop.
That may well prove to be the case. It may well prove that it's not something that the public at large will have decided that we ought to stop, because obviously no final decision has been made. Certainly when you invest a lot of energy and effort into something, there is a tendency to want to carry through with that. I don't look at it in quite the same way. And this sort of harkens back to what has now become a part of our formula, a part of our program. We now do feasibility studies. We do long-term assessments. We do, excuse me, far more extensive analyses of what will or won't work. And if it is going to be used, what do we have to do to minimize its deleterious effects? I see that simply as being responsible analysis prior to answering a question, not momentum or evidence for pursuing a certain answer. The question of CSITNA as an option for solving rail belt energy needs has to be answered in the next 2 or 3 years. But the whole equation has been modified recently with the conversion from a 2-dam to a 3-dam proposal, with the continuing reductions in oil prices and the additional caution that is causing people to employ in their long-term oil price projections, which is one of the key things. It affects things not only in terms of what the cost of the alternative energies are, it also affects Alaska directly in terms of its demand, in terms of its population growth curves. It's as seems to almost be the case, Alaska is in a unique situation where the oil prices not only affect the alternative power sources, but it also affects the very demand equations.
And further than the demand equations, it also affects how much money we have to invest in future energy.
Precisely.
So it could be a spiral that well changes directions and starts going in the opposite direction from what it has gone. I think that when they first started discussing CSITNA in this state, it seemed that there would be just ample money to make this investment. And that just is a drastically altered picture at this point.
Right. And hopefully, at least one lesson, regardless of what decision is made, that we will learn from that is far more humility and less confidence in our long-term projections than we were in many directions willing to maintain 10 years ago, when we thought that the oil money would come in and we could build 3 CSITNAs or 10 state capitals or whatever it might have been. We should consider ourselves fortunate that we didn't commit ourselves to things then that we'd be scraping the bottom of the barrel for now.
One can go from riches to poverty fairly quickly.
Well, we're by no means a depauperate or impoverished state.
Certainly
at all.
Not.
We're blessed with revenues from the harvesting of our natural resources, primarily oil, but also fisheries and to a limited degree timber, and certainly our vast natural beauty and scenic resources, with with a very healthy foundation. We simply have to learn how to live within those means and figure out the best way to employ those means in the long term. And if we find that our projections for vast expansion are now not so clear, that doesn't mean we still don't have a very dynamic and progressive future ahead of us. I think it's clear to say that we do. Alaska is going to grow, we're going to develop further, and that's going to benefit all of us. It may not be quite in the directions we'd envisioned 5 or 10 years ago, or the extent that we'd envisioned 5 or 10 years ago. That may also mean that we shouldn't think in terms of spending so much money on one big project as a Susitna project, but still, as I say, that's something that's going to have to still be assessed for a while.
Sounds like you're encouraging not only realism, but flexibility.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm speaking with Jeff Bowman, who is the executive director of ACPIRG, which is Alaska's public interest research group.
You got it right. I do, too, occasionally.
What specifically has ACPIRG done in relation to public utilities? What specifically have you worked on so that people have a better idea?
Well, I mentioned earlier that we have a subordinate program called the Alaska Consumer Advocacy Program. And this program was instituted in 1981. And it is funded separately from ACPIRG's activities by a state grant. And the role that ACAP is to play is to intervene or advocate on behalf of residential utility consumers before the Public Utilities Commission. The process for, I suspect many listeners who are unaware, is that the various utilities will identify, based on their own internal calculations, what sorts of rate increases or billing policies or management policies are necessary for them to maintain pace with what their projections are for demand and cost and so on. And they present those findings to the Public Utilities Commission, typically in what's called a tariff application, which amounts to a request for a rate increase. It might be an interim rate increase pending a long-term decision, because they do, at least in some cases, go through periodic review and rate decision-making. It might be at one of those permanent rate increases. The ACAP program represents the utility consumers before the Public Utilities Commission. There is a broad-scale misperception that the Public Utilities Commission represents or accommodates the concerns of the public in its deliberations. And of course, the commissioners do attempt to do that. But the process, in fact, does not enable them to, on their own, do an adequate job of that, because they are charged with making a decision based on the information that they receive. They have a staff which analyzes materials from an independent perspective and makes its own recommendations. They receive information from the utilities themselves, who have their staffs and legal assistants to present the utilities' perspective. But there isn't anybody out there to present the perspective of the individual ratepayer, the residential ratepayer. Certainly the major industrial consumers are able to involve themselves at any time they need to. Maybe they need to be more represented. That's not our role. But our role certainly is to represent the individual person out at the end of the meter or the end of the phone line. And as we discussed earlier, it's very difficult for an individual to realize what all goes on in that tariff application. And so our purpose is to investigate those, determine whether or not the financial statements adequately reflect what is going on, whether the requests are reasonable, and oftentimes we will simply be able to make comments before the commission, and that may succeed in having a decision handed down which requires behavior a bit more sensitive or responsive to the consumer. At other times we may need to be so aggressive as to intervene in a legal sense in the regulatory process, and that then of course takes more of our time.
So you aren't necessarily going to be in an adverse position with the utility companies. I mean, there may be issues that you agree on.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just that
absolutely.
You're there to sort of take a look at it from with some experts which are on your staff in a way that a regular public user could not. I mean, the only
right.
thing I could
Precisely.
Go and say is, I need adequate energy and I want my bills to stay reasonable.
Right. If you would like to go and read through the 3- and 4-inch stacks of papers on each of these dockets, you would be able to perform the same function that we do. But of course, that's not practical. If you did, we wouldn't get to listen to you on Saturday mornings.
It's not what I'd like to do with my spare time, actually, even if I were capable.
So we do have our professional staff of an attorney and an economist and an office person, and they work on those issues.
So there are some times that they will be in agreement. It's just that at some points, they may really say, wait a minute, we think that the consumer may be having to pay a very high
That's
bill.
That's right.
Washington State is a good case in
mm-hmm.
point. I mean, they are having to pay for energy facilities that are not online and that they no longer need now, or at least do not need at the moment. And so
That's
they're
right.
paying for energy that they are not getting.
That's a very good example. And I could provide one in-state example of where, I could provide several, but I'll limit myself to one, in which the ACAP program has succeeded within Alaska. We don't have sufficient staff to deal with all the different utilities, so we have confined our efforts to gas, electric, and telecommunications issues. We've not dealt with water issues or sewer or trash issues. Alascom, of course, is the major carrier of long-distance phone service in Alaska. And telecommunications is a very complex issue, and I'm not even capable of distilling it, let alone will I try. But in a nutshell, Alascom had sought to have permission to increase their rates late in 1984 because they feared that a subsidy that they were receiving from the from AT&T, from the nationwide long-distance carrier, was going to be lost and that they were going to have to make up for that shortfall in some way. ACAP and others as well intervened saying, well, you know, we're not so sure that you're going to lose that subsidy. And if, in fact, you do, that's when it is appropriate to seek an increase.
Let's not make approval of increased
right.
tariff based on revenue that you haven't, in fact,
lost yet. And the commission agreed with us and denied that rate increase. And Alascom users are paying in aggregate $1 million less per month than they would have been had that approval gone through, and that's now been about a year. So there's been a $12 million savings in calculating it that way to Alascom users so far. And, of course, that will pertain as long as the subsidy continues and the rate increase isn't necessary.
Besides public utilities, what is your recent work with ACPRG? I mean, or no, that's ACAP,
which is
okay.
a subordinate unit of ACPRG. I'm responsible for overseeing the organization and the operation, but it does have its own independent funding and staff.
Okay. Now, ACPRG, what were some of the first projects that ACPRG worked on?
Well, the very first one that ACPRG got involved with was a grocery price survey in 1974 in Anchorage. And that survey indicated some broad discrepancies in the prices between different grocery stores, even within the same chain, for the same product, same size, same brand, same everything. And in fact, one store closed for a day in order to reprice things. That having been the first real issue continues to hold a place near and dear in our hearts. And the grocery price surveys did continue for some time, but they have been undone for quite some time, and that's one thing that I hope to reinstitute is grocery price surveys. We were also involved in issues with the Teamsters Union and a whole wide range of things over the years, and now we are into quite a smorgasbord of things.
The grocery price survey, it sometimes seems to me going from store to store that certain things will be cheaper one place than another, but other things will be much more expensive. And so in the end, you sort of even things out. But it is, unless you have a lot of time, it's very difficult to go around and comparison shop on a regular basis for yourself.
Right.
And so that definitely is an advantage, although there are all these convenience stores that seem to be doing quite well, and they're coming up like mushrooms in Fairbanks.
Yes, that's true.
And they really do charge because of their very nature. They're convenient, they're open a lot of hours, but they certainly are more expensive for foods.
Well, I think we'll save till later on some of the Fairbanks specific questions and what's going on with ACPERG here in Fairbanks. But in finishing up on the grocery side of the polygon, I at least have an interest in exploring the whole question of unit pricing and how many people out there are confident that the price that the shelf label says they're paying for that item that they pull off of the shelf is the price that's actually getting registered when it's read by the computer on the screen as it goes by the counter. The fact that individual units or items are no longer given a price on them, but in fact you're relying on someone to have properly entered in the material. I have no doubt that that those systems work well and that by and large they are very correct. But I think it's important that we do a check of it at some point in some way, and that we determine whether the inevitable margin of error is sufficient enough to justify what I'm sure would be additional cost to maintain individual pricing of items.
Yeah, I certainly understand the efficiency. I understand that it creates an ongoing inventory at any time, and it's probably very labor-saving. But certainly I find the experience is much like shopping blind, because unless you are just a very conscientious shopper, it is hard to look at those little tags and figure out, is this price that's below the item I'm about to grab for the item I'm grabbing, or is it the item at 1.5 inches away, and which brand is at what price? And you have to have reasonably good eyesight to even decipher some of.
And you have to be tall enough to get up to some of those upper shelves too, don't you?
So it's not something that's sort of immediately obvious to you as you grab it and it says $1.69 right on the top. I definitely think that's something that the consumer really isn't kind of, on a day-to-day basis, really aware of the price unless they take the stuff home and really look at their ticket. All right. Grocery prices. Now, what else did you work on?
Well, the way we sort of look at what we do is it's in a threefold direction. We have, first of all, the consumer issues, which would be grocery prices, the utility project work that we discussed earlier, bank interest rate surveys, banking services guides. We've put out a variety of guides to different services that are available, different consumer aids over the years.
Let's stop here and talk about that a minute so we don't have to circle back to it. That also has hit the news. It turns out that MasterCards or Visa cards, all of these charge cards, do not have a consistent interest rate that is charged to the customer, that you can have a MasterCard out of one bank that has a very different service charge and interest rate than one obtained through another bank. And I heard a news story that was suggesting that consumers really pay attention to that and make sure that their sponsorship is by a bank that's giving an acceptable interest rate. I was not even aware that it wasn't, until I heard that story, that it wasn't even, that it wasn't a consistent
interest.
That's right.
We have been involved only in the legislative context, at least to my knowledge, on this specific issue, in that we have been fighting to maintain legislation that would hold a ceiling on the percentage rate above the prime rate that could be charged for credit cards.
I think we need to talk about that bill that in fact was in the legislature last year and is
still
undoubtedly
there,
going to resurface this year. And would you describe that bill for our audience in case they aren't familiar with it?
Well, I honestly have not been able to research it closely myself in my 3 months. It's a bill having to do with raising or eliminating the ceiling on the interest
rate. It allows the banks to set with individual customers an interest rate based on their credit rating. And this, in fact, has been a trend in other states. And I know enough to say that in Chicago, where Illinois passed such a law, the interest rate on car loans in inner city Chicago, where poorer people live, is up as high as 50%. That really strikes me as
backwards in some ways.
And in fact, it has a really profound effect on newly divorced or newly widowed women who do not have a previous credit rating, who then have to go out and purchase a vehicle to get to work and have no credit history.
Right.
And so those people are the logical people to charge higher interest rates because they are apparent risks.
Right. It's as with so many issues, it's one that has broad implications to a lot of segments of the public and to everyone in one degree or another. And as a result, it very much is something that we would try to spend our time on. As I say, it is one of dozens of issues and one of the ones that I've not yet been able to focus on very thoroughly.
The people, of course, who are lobbying for this are the banks. And to be fair to them, and I'm not a banker, I think that they feel that they take a lot of risk with certain categories of loans, and the default rate is relatively high, and I think that that's the basis on which they're justifying this. And so there's the two sides of the argument, but I would urge our listeners to follow this session, because this is something that very much consumers are going to need to advocate for their side if they
absolutely
want to hold the line here.
Absolutely, and it's something that we'll be following, and as I mentioned earlier, when we talk about ACPERC activities in Fairbanks, we can suggest some opportunities for them to try and work on these things.
Okay, so back to our sort of outline.
Our trilogy.
Your trilogy. You have the consumer...
The consumer issues, which include the interest rates, grocery price surveys, and so on. We also, on a second leg of the triangle, deal with the energy and as a result, because of the dominant role that energy questions play in Alaska, budgetary considerations. And this is dealing with, like the Sioux Sitna Hydroelectric Project, with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, the TAPS tariffs, with the question of what sort of an accounting scheme should be applied to the oil companies to determine what income should be taxed. Those are the three major issues currently within that part of the ACPERC agenda that are probably of some familiarity to at least some of the listeners. I think I would like to speak right now, since we talked about Sioux Sitna earlier, about the lawsuit that we were a part of, that we are a part of, with a legal firm, Trustees for Alaska, based in Anchorage. We filed suit in late 1984 challenging the constitutionality of a scheme that had been installed by the legislature to provide financing for three different programs. Well, one program and two projects: the Sioux Sitna Hydroelectric Project, the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, and what's called the Power Cost Equalization Program, which is basically a subsidy to rural communities to hold their much more costly electric rates in line with rail belt energy rates. And it's it's a subsidy that's calculated on a monthly basis. We received a lot of attention for being a part of that lawsuit, and although it was filed in late 1984, it was not heard in or argued in court until this past summer. And our argument had nothing to do with the merits of the individual programs per se. Our concern was that the legislature had passed laws in 1984 which said that money would be appropriated in that year and in each succeeding year to finance those three programs. And of course, this was a political reflection of what we talked about earlier in terms of a comprehensive statewide solution. We need to have one, but it needs to be based on need and not on politics. And this, in fact, was a political solution. Southeast would have its four dam pool issues taken care of. Bradley Lake would get money, Susitna would get money, and in return, rural Alaska would have their electric rates subsidized. And we would all commit and buy into doing that into the future. Well, in fact, there is a provision in the Alaska Constitution which says that funds may not be dedicated. In other words, future legislators cannot be bound by the decisions of earlier legislators. And that's an eminently wise approach to take. Each year, we have to be able to analyze what our situation is, decide what we can spend, what we can't spend, and go from there. And it was on that basis that ACPIRG challenged the appropriations. And that was discomforting to many people. It was discomforting to people who were unalterably supportive of Susitna. It was unpleasant to the many people who saw Bradley Lake as being a project ready to go. Financing had been arranged, and here some of the money was being pulled out from under them. And certainly it concerned rural Alaska greatly, and in some ways, I guess, surprised rural Alaska, because we have long fought on utility issues that have benefited them as well as mm-hmm. any other people in the state. But we couldn't sit idly by and have an unconstitutional action on the part of the legislature go unchallenged. Mm-hmm. These projects each need to be evaluated on their merits, and that was how we approached it. We were upheld in the Superior Court. We expect to be upheld on appeal. The legislature has made it clear that they will properly reauthorize the funding that is necessary for these different things, and we'll be working to see that rural Alaska's needs are taken care of, that the Bradley Lake project is an excellent example of a good tailored hydroelectric project that can come online in a reasonable amount of time, provide a reasonable amount of electricity. We don't like being shot for the message.
It wasn't a criticism of the projects or some of the projects involved in that.
It had nothing to do
itself.
With
it
that.
It was the idea of dedicating future funds, and really, if that were to create precedent and it weren't fought in the courts by someone, you can imagine that declining oil revenues, you have a legislature dedicating far into the future
That's right.
A number of issues, and you have a legislature who gets there in 10 or 15 years with no money to spend because it's all dedicated.
That's right. I've had the situation of Texas recounted to me, which I'm not completely familiar with, but it's my understanding that in Texas they have only about 15% of their annual revenues available to discretionarily distribute to various things, because everything else is locked in. It's already packaged and sent on to some dedicated direction. And that was not the direction that Alaska's constitutional framers wanted Alaska to go.
It's a sort of long-range planning taken to the extreme.
Yes, right.
I mean, usually the criticism is that we don't do enough
right.
coherent and comprehensive long-range planning. Probably for ourselves as individuals, and certainly institutions have that problem, but this would be an extreme example of long-range planning. I'm speaking to the executive director of ACPIRG, which is Alaska Public Interest Research Group.
Twice in a row.
it's a winner. Jeff Bowman, and he's up from Anchorage, visiting us in Fairbanks. All right, so we've covered the sort of general interest areas.
Consumer issues, right. And touched on the budgetary and energy issues. And the third area is just governmental process, public policy process. And in fact, that Susitna lawsuit in some ways touches on that issue, of course. But where we really focus in that realm is on things such as campaign financing or legislative ethics or public access to government information through Freedom of Information Act or open meetings policy or the Fairness Doctrine. That is the third direction in which we operate and on which we've been active lately.
A lot of ethical issues that have arisen in the state in the last
That's
couple
right.
of years, looking to the processes and how they can ensure ethics is your approach, not a decision on a individual act, whether it was ethical or not, but
Correct.
How did the process protect ethics
Correct.
In
exactly.
government? And, of course, campaign funding is a big issue that's really facing the nation and also the state of Alaska. It's very difficult for someone to run for office now if they don't have some considerable wealth as an individual, and some fear of over undue influence by PACs as a result of some recent legislation. It doesn't seem to be a real easy thing. Much of the legislation that has resulted in the increased power of PACs was intended to really diversify the funding sources,
right.
but this is a sort of unforeseen consequence.
That's right. We have to find some way to ensure that each individual has the freedom of expression to support fully something or someone that they want to support. But we also have to ensure that individuals' relative capacity to do so is not so overwhelming that it takes us away from the fundamental democratic concept of one person, one vote. And therein lies the central rub. How we're going to do that is very difficult to grapple with. The most attractive scheme to many of us, that being public financing of campaigns, such as we do for the presidential election, can only go so far. It does seem as though it would at least ensure that any person, regardless of their personal economic wealth or connections, could be a candidate. And that's a very, very essential part of our democratic process, especially for us here in Alaska. We talk about having a citizen legislature composed of a legitimate cross-section of our population. And in fact, based on that, we to date have not been willing to pay them a lot, although they recently had a pay raise to try and compensate for some of that. Nonetheless, those people are expected to have other jobs, and except for the 6 months that they're in session, to be doing something else to make their way. In fact, you know that we write to our legislators in August and October, and they certainly have to be preparing for the year ahead and can't turn themselves off.
I ran into Nilo Kopanen at a recent event, and we were trying to combine some time on our schedule. It was just impossible. And they were actually political functions,
sure,
that he was attending, and this is very much the off-season.
And in many ways accountable and responsible for.
Yes. And the press of events is so great when the legislature is in session that if you don't get out front and do a little research and do a little thinking and do a little reading, I imagine it would be just overwhelming when you got there if you tried to start from the beginning.
Right.
When you arrived, in terms
that's
of your
right.
thinking on some central issues.
That's right. And that's clearly a reflection of how, even if we want to have a citizen legislature, we have to be prepared to not only pay the price, but also make the effort and provide the environment in which it can be a truly citizen legislature. And what I'm getting at here is the campaign financing. If we are going to operate in a system which places a premium on having a lot of personal wealth or a connection to a lot of personal wealth in order to become a legislator, then we're cutting off the school teachers. We're cutting off the, in many cases, the professionals who have occupations that they can't set aside. We're cutting off the laborers or the average homeowners, people who may have a lot of talent and insight and energy to give to their state and to give to the political process, but it would be much too intimidating an effort for them to try and pursue. So some sort of public financing seems to address that sort of a question, or at least we need to do something about that. But that still doesn't end up solving the problem of, if I'm going to be a candidate and I'm going to accept public financing and I'm going to count on my opponent to do the same, so we're supposedly equal, that doesn't limit you, who are a wealthy network executive, of deciding you want to support my opponent and giving that person another extra $100,000 or whatever it might be. And you have a freedom of expression right to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But at what point does that intrude on your next-door neighbor's opportunity to have equal involvement and influence on the election of one candidate or another?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kinds of fundamental democratic governmental questions that drive ACPIRG's interest in campaign financing, legislative ethics, or whatever.
Alaska is a particularly expensive state to campaign in because of the travel costs and because
of communication costs.
And the communication costs. And I think that's probably the principal expense in most campaigns is the TV and radio time. And it's very expensive. In fact, at a certain point, the rate to politicians goes up to sort of protect some time on the airwaves. We have a lot of candidates running right now, and the election isn't even until next fall. So
we're
a full 7-8 months away, mm-hmm. and yet there are many people who are already in the race. I suppose the fear of only public funding is that too many people will run, and it will just become such an unwieldy... Without the constraint of
right.
the fundraising, that just anyone who had something they wanted to say, so debates would be 50 candidates or...
There are, of course, you can go from zero to infinity in terms of the number of requirements or limitations that you could incorporate within public financing in terms of minimum criteria that you would have to meet. For instance, an equivalent situation occurred with the Libertarian Party a few years ago, that they were not permitted to be on the ballot because they weren't considered a viable party that had met the minimum requirements to have automatic representation on the ballot. But then Dick Randolph did a heck of a job campaigning and gathered the necessary minimum amount of votes in an election to ensure that from that point henceforth, at least for some minimum period of time, that the Libertarian Party would automatically be able to have its candidate on the ballot. The same sort of thing can be applied to potential candidates.
A petition.
A minimum number of signatories from their district or a minimum initial amount of campaign fundraising in pieces of $100 or less or something similar so that they meet some criteria at which point they then have matching funds or public funds.
It seems to be a rule that it's much easier to expand and get things to be more expensive and more elaborate than it is to contract or simplify.
Right.
It's easier to add on than it is to pull back.
Well, we just have to be careful that we're really looking at the costs of the different things. So one thing that many people say is, well, geez, does that mean we're going to have to pay more taxes or we're going to have less money to spend on something else if we're going to pay for campaigns? The fact is that there's only so much money printed, there's only so much money available, there's only so much fiscal capacity of a society. And you know that there's no free lunch. So the money's coming from somewhere. And if you look at the broad costs, either strictly in terms of that money flow or the broad costs in terms of the loss of a democratic process when we have the economically powerful providing undue influence, I have no doubt that the costs are such that I would prefer to see things done in some sort of an across-the-board fashion where that economic influence is not a part of our electoral process.
Mm-hmm. I agree. You're coming here to try and get some interest or more involvement on the part of Fairbanksons?
Well, the organization is the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, and the work that we have done has long benefited all Alaskans. But we are a nonprofit organization. Our membership of 500 is so far concentrated in Anchorage. Our office is in Anchorage. I'm the only paid staff person, and there's a lot of volunteer and intern help. But in order for us to truly meet successfully all of these issues, we want to be able to be more responsive than we've been able to be throughout the state. The consumer advisory program, the utility program that we talked about earlier, in its early years had some advisory committees set up in different communities. Those were lost over time as the funding mechanisms were altered. But my goal as I've come in as executive director is to broaden our board and to broaden our active involvement. And Brian Rogers, past state legislator who is active here in Fairbanks, is on our board, and we are working to revitalize the membership that is here, to through this program and other efforts, let people know about ACPIRG and that there is an opportunity for them to be involved in these kinds of issues, if by nothing else than their membership. We are going to have an organizational meeting to try and set up basically a volunteer affiliate that could meet on a monthly basis, for instance, and discuss what issues are going on locally, provide me and the statewide board with the information necessary to properly incorporate Fairbanks' concerns into these issues, and to just make ACPIRG perform its role that much more fully and representatively.
Participation on in some advisory capacity means that people have a regular mechanism for calling your attention to things that they think you should be researching.
That's right.
That you should be interested in. I assume that it was some kind of formal or informal public interest that chose the issues that you've outlined for us that you are presently working on.
That's correct. It's been the decisions of the board members who are elected by the membership. So in that sense, it is reflective of that public concern, and of course the board is generally able to identify as capable individuals the sorts of things that have broad public impact. And of course there's one word that I hate to use that I've had to learn to use since I've started at ACPIRG, and that is the word no or I'm sorry. I mean, we have such limited capability, and I hope to be able to expand that. But we certainly want to know about what's going on, and even if I can't help someone find a lawyer to get their dog out of the dog pound or whatever it might be, we need to know what's going on. We need to be sensitive to that. We need to have a mechanism for people to let us know, and hopefully by becoming more widely known, we can generate the resources and the support necessary to pursue more of those.
Yeah, if you had quadruple or tenfold the membership, you could address more issues, obviously.
Well, I don't doubt that there are, thousands of people in the state who would feel that their $25 annual membership was worthwhile to ensure that these sorts of issues we've been talking about are being addressed by an organization like ACPIRG.
And we are out of time, but I guess the main message that I got here today is that it's not necessarily a specific interest, that it is an information group above all, and that it isn't necessarily adversary on a
That's
lot of
right.
these issues with the more mainstream interests. It's just information for the public so that we can make informed choices about the way our public monies are being spent.
We define public interest as that which benefits no single individual or group any more so than any other single individual or group. We're trying to define, some people have called it the lowest common denominator. I myself refer to it as the highest common denominator. And I hope we'll see people at 7:30 Monday evening at the Wood Center Memorial Conference Room, where we'll be having our organizational meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much for being in the studio with me. This has been Homefires Radio Show, and I have been talking with Jeff Bauman, the Executive Director of ACPIRG. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. Our producer is Carla Tanella. I hope you have a very nice weekend.
Thanks for having me.